Good afternoon. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarit.
And I'm Cherry Gregg, and this is Studio 2 on a Thursday afternoon in the fall. I cannot believe. Like, I know.
No lies told. That's all true.
Look, on October 1st, you were like, Cherry, aren't you going to say time is flying?
Don't
and I'm like, no, of course not. But now I feel it.
No.
It hit me
this
week.
The feeling is
the
back.
The feeling has hit me. So,
okay.
By the way, today is day 3 of the dock worker strike, and it's impacting a number of ports and terminals all along the East and Gulf Coast. And Avi, I was watching the news this morning, mm-hmm. and people are already panic buying. At Costco. Like, I don't know why they're doing this, but they're doing this.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know these people. So, you know, before you run out and buy up all the toilet paper and the liquor, okay, we figured we'd do what we do on Studio 2 and bring in some experts and help us figure out how this strike will impact the supply chain and all of us. And we want to hear from you. If you or a family member has worked at the Port of Philadelphia or the Port of Wilmington, what do you think about the strike? And if you're a trucker affected by the work stoppage or a retailer or a business dependent on this overseas supply chain, how is this impacting you? You should call us. The number is 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
888-477-9499 is studio2@whyy.org. We've got a great guest with us for the second and third segments this hour. But before we get there, Cherry.
Oh, yes.
I got to stop the show for a second because we're trying something new today.
So we like to try new things.
We do.
We're adventurous people here.
We're experimenters. We're innovators, you might even say. So turn your radio up a little bit because this is audience participation based. So usually at the end of the show, we hear some music that's related to the theme of the show. The producers pick the music. It always kind of sets the tone for the end of the show, brings us out of the show. We appreciate the producers so much for making those picks. But we thought, what if we made the audience in charge of that final song of the week?
I like it.
You like that idea?
I like it because our audience is so good. They're so good at stuff like that.
They're
this.
Innovators
yeah.
just like us.
They are.
So we want you to be Studio 2's DJ.
Mm.
We want you to send a song suggestion for the end of the show right now to studio2@whyy.org. And then we're going to sift through all the entries, pick one, and shout out the kind of winner mm-hmm. at the end of the hour. So we were looking for a song that's related to the theme of today's show. So think, you know, docks and unions, workers,
strikes
mm-hmm. automation, whatever you come up with. Send the name of the song and your name to studio2@whyy.org no later than 12:30 because we need time to cut the song and fit it in the show, okay?
Yeah, and I'll put this in there to get sure. people's, you know, juices flowing in their brains.
What, you're going to take one of the songs?
No. We did a song earlier this week.
Oh.
You know, I Got the Power
okay.
was the song that was chosen. I got the power.
Yeah.
For this week's show on nuclear energy. That's
got
one
it.
Example. Or Dolly Parton's 9 to 5 for work-related topics. But this is, so you can use other ones, but we're just
yeah.
giving you examples.
Well, don't do 9 to 5.
No, do
point,
that. No,
because
no. It's already taken.
It's already taken. Okay. So let's do our trio of local news stories. And let's start with a debate. Yes, there's a debate happening tonight. Mm. No, not the vice presidential debate. That already happened. This is a debate between Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania and his Republican challenger, Dave McCormick. Casey, the Democrat. McCormick, the Republican. Casey seeking a fourth term. McCormick already ran for the Senate once, lost in the Republican primary narrowly to Dr. Oz in 2022. This time, he's in the big race against Casey. This is a very, very expensive race. Casey has attacked McCormick for spending a lot of time in Connecticut, calling him a carpetbagger.
Yeah.
That did seem to work against Dr. Mm-hmm. Oz in 2022. Here's Casey on NBC News yesterday.
When you seek to represent the people of Pennsylvania, 13 million people, and to represent them as their senator, you should not start your campaign by lying about where you live.
Now, McCormick has his strategy tying Casey very closely to Vice President Kamala Harris. Here is McCormick in Indiana, Pennsylvania last week at a rally for former President Donald Trump.
These radical liberal policies under Kamala Harris, and Bob Casey's going to vote for her 99% of the time because he is a weak leader and a rubber stamp for this liberal agenda.
All right, the debate is tonight at 8. You can watch on PHL 17 or stream it. There's also going to be a debate on October 15th as well between these two gentlemen. Cherry, any comments? What are you looking forward to?
Yeah,
what do you got?
I mean, this is, you know, everybody's been talking about the presidential, you know, race
yeah.
and have ignored some of the other races on the ballot. And this is one to pay attention to. Why? Because Democrats currently hold a Senate majority by the narrowest of margins. And it's a pretty difficult Senate map. So if Casey loses, this could guarantee Republican control of the Senate. And that's why everybody sort of paying attention to this race. So a lot is at stake. Yep. In just a few days. I mean, we're at, what, 33 days before the election?
Something
at this
like
point?
That.
Yeah.
If you trust the polls,
mm-hmm.
the polls would suggest that Casey has consistently pulled
ahead
of Harris.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
McCormick has consistently pulled behind Trump. So I think the question for McCormick is, what do you do? Do you try to take some of those Harris voters and make them split ticket voters, mm-hmm. Harris-McCormick voters, or do you say the only way I can win this thing is massive turnout on the Republican side?
Yeah.
I need Trump to win Pennsylvania by like 3, 4, 5 points, and then I can ride on those coattails. Because so far, there do seem to be some people who are Casey Trump people. Mm-hmm. And so that's a problem for McCormick. So we'll see.
We'll be watching.
We'll see what his strategy is tonight on PHL 17, 8 o'clock.
Yeah, a glimmer of hope here.
Okay.
The rate of overdose deaths in the city of Philadelphia may have dropped for the first time in 5 years. But on the other hand, some groups have seen an increase in the number of overdose deaths. All this data comes from the Philadelphia Department of Public Health. It's estimated that a little over 1,100 residents died from unintentional drug overdoses in 2023. And the year before that, it was a little over 1,200. So there was about a 7% decrease there.
Yeah.
And of course, all of this information is preliminary and subject to change. But while most advocates see this as good news, Avi, there's a racial divide that is beginning to emerge. The number of overdoses among Black residents remains elevated, while the deaths of white residents continues to go down. And Black men are now significantly more likely to die of an unintentional overdose. And that overdose rate among that population twice as high as it was the year before, and twice as high last year as the city's overall overdose death rate. So they are two times more likely, to die than, you know, other folks. So this is serious stuff.
2017, this was almost a polar opposite picture.
Yeah.
The overdose death rate among white residents of the city was far higher than for Black residents and Latino residents as well. So
mm-hmm.
these trend lines are going in opposite directions, depending on which demographic group you're in.
And you're wondering, is it the messaging? Is it, you know, what is it that is creating this racial divide? And so advocates are looking at this very closely.
As they should.
Mm-hmm.
One more story before we get to our main segment today. So if you watch Fox, the TV channel,
mm-hmm.
on Sundays, you know that they air football during the
fall.
They do. And then Sunday night after football, Fox will often air shows that it's really trying to launch into the stratosphere,
mm-hmm.
because they get that football audience and they can convert to viewers for that Sunday night lineup. So when I was a kid, Cherry, Sunday night, you would watch Malcolm in the Middle.
I remember that show.
Which was a big hit. And The Simpsons, which is, of course,
an iconic show.
X-Files used to be on Sunday night Fox.
Oh, yeah.
King of the Hill, Family Guy, Bob's Burgers, which I've never seen, but I've heard is very good. But the latest show to get into this coveted time slot is from a couple of Philly area guys. And the show is called Universal Basic Guys. It's a cartoon comedy, sound familiar, kind of like The Simpsons,
mm-hmm.
Family Guy, featuring a large cartoon. A large main character.
Mm-hmm.
And his name is Mark Hoagies.
Ah.
He is the star of Universal Basic Guys. Let's hear a little clip of Universal Basic Guys starring the character Mark Hoagies.
Mark, a soft pretzel is not dinner. That's dessert.
No, David, the cinnamon sugar soft pretzel is dessert, but the cheese pretzel can absolutely be dinner.
It's got no nutritional value.
Neither does lettuce, David.
Recognize that accent.
Yeah.
And by the way, the premise of this show, Universal Basic Guys, actually ties into our show today. So the characters are these guys who've been laid off from factory jobs because of artificial intelligence, but they're in a pilot program for universal basic income. So this is their life in a post-work world. Universal Basic, guys. The creators are from Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And so we'll see. Maybe it's the next big thing on
Maybe
Fox.
Maybe it is. I love the accent. It seemed pretty authentic. And based on the trailer, well, they course. Had some really good, you know, jokes mixed in there. I don't know if I'm the demo for this because I really
don't
even watch.
Sold to me.
I don't watch a lot of football, but I feel like, you know.
It was a game effort.
Yeah.
You tried to talk it up.
Yeah,
and I
did.
Give you credit for that.
I did. But Sunday Night Football ratings have been really good. So this could really launch the show, you know.
Yeah.
Pretty high. Yeah.
All right.
And so
be on the lookout for Universal Basic, guys.
And so coming up, we're going to be talking about the dock worker strike.
Yeah.
And if you've worked on a dock, you know somebody, if you have a business that might be impacted by the supply chain, call us 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
These foreign companies are putting machines in, taking out our jobs. Foreign companies taking American jobs away. You still got negotiations going on. It doesn't look like it's going well. We'll see how it happens, but we're striking for wages naturally. Technology is a big part.
We worked through COVID. We didn't stop. A lot of people, I guess you really don't think about that as longshoremen being on the front lines, like they say.
Welcome back. This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. You just heard there from dock workers Daniel Gallagher and Dylan Snively from the Port of Philadelphia. They spoke recently with our news partner, 6ABC. This is, as you probably know, day three of the longshoremen strike, which involves Philadelphia and other terminals along the East and Gulf Coast. Dock workers are asking for better wages and, crucially, protection from automation.
But if this drags out, there's concern it could stall the economy as all those goods, auto parts, bananas, holiday toys, sit on ships idling at sea. We could see shortages and prices rise again. So today, we're going to talk about the strike and its potential impact on the supply chain and inflation. We'll also look at the power of labor unions and the threat of machines taking our jobs. Our guest is Peter Goodman, global economic correspondent for the New York Times, who has been covering the dock worker strike. He's the author of the new book, How the World Ran Out of Everything. Peter, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's so nice to have you, Peter, because you know this thing inside and out. And in addition to hearing from you this hour, we want to hear from our listeners, okay? Especially if you're a listener who knows someone who works at a port or is a trucker, perhaps yourself impacted by this stoppage. Maybe you work at a company dependent on the supply chain. We want to know, how is the strike impacting you now? How might it impact you moving forward? And of course, are you worried about automation replacing jobs in your field? Now, if you're not in any of those industries, we also want to hear from you as well. Just your general thoughts on this work stoppage, on automation. So email us, studio2@whyy.org, or call 888-477-9499.
And so, Peter, we want to start by getting a basic understanding of what's happening. Who exactly is on strike and what is the geographical impact?
Yeah, you bet. So there's about 45,000 dock workers who are part of the International Longshoremen's Association. These are people who move freight on and off of ships. They have walked off their jobs at 14 major ports on the East Coast and the Gulf Coast of the United States. That has essentially shut down 36 shipping terminals at those 14 ports. And that has got a lot of people concerned about significant economic damage.
So how did we get here, Peter? Why now? Because maybe a lot of you have read at this point, this particular union has not struck in a long, long time. So why now? How did we get here?
Well, organized labor is having a moment in the United States. I mean, we've had very low, by historical standards, unemployment rates now for several years. And a lot of working people in the U.S. have had the sense, and it's borne out by data, that over decades, they've seen their wages stagnate and in some cases just downgrade. We've lost a lot of job security. Unions represent a much smaller slice of the working population than they used to. And we've seen corporate profits increase, but we've seen a breakdown since the late 1970s of working people getting a commensurate share of those gains. And it took the pandemic disruptions to have a lot of people, you know, often stuck at home if they were lucky enough to be in those jobs, or blue collar people who had to work through the pandemic, who were often deemed essential workers, who had to risk their lives. And as unemployment dropped, it spiked at the beginning of the pandemic, but then it came way down. And as it dropped, a lot of people who never had alternatives suddenly did. And for organized labor, that's meant much greater leverage than it's ever enjoyed. And we've seen this, you know, look at the UAW strike, where some people said the UAW is overplaying its hand, took a very confrontational tone. A stance, rather, with the big three automakers, and it got hefty raises. We've seen similar dynamics at, you know, the Amazon warehouse in Staten Island, New York, really anti-union shop. They managed to organize out in Hollywood. The actors and the writers endured a long strike. So basically, it's a moment where organized labor feels like it's got muscle.
Empowered. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, one quick just context point to add. This is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So they track major work stoppages involving 1,000-plus workers. And at one point in the mid-70s, there were over 400 of these work stoppages per year. That had plummeted to 5 by 2009. But recently, as Peter alluded to, we have seen a small but noticeable uptick, 33 such stoppages in 2022. And that's the latest year for which data is available. So perhaps it's gone up even more since then, Cherry.
Yes, it has. And so the dock workers realize they have leverage and this is the moment. Can you talk about what they're asking for?
Yeah. So they're asking for some pretty hefty wages. If you look at the headline numbers, they want they've come down from an initial ask of 77% wage increases over a six-year contract to something more like 60%. But the real sticking point is they want job security in the face of rising automation. They want language that actually prevents more automation at ports, as they see automation as a way to undercut their jobs and replace paychecks with robots. Robots don't go on strike. They don't have kids to take care of. They don't get sick. Robots just do the job that they've been entrusted with.
And by the way, we are talking about this major work stoppage at ports along the East and Gulf Coast with Peter Goodman of the New York Times. We'd love to hear your thoughts, especially if you're someone who's impacted by one of these industries or you're in one of these industries, have a family member in one of these industries. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. One thing that has come up already is the fact that these particular blue-collar workers, Peter, are compensated better than other people in the supply chain business somewhere along the way. Can you give us some context for that? And does that create tension between the dock workers and other people who depend on the dock workers?
Yeah, it's a super important dimension to this. So, yeah, the dock workers have historically been pretty militant. Actually, this East Coast union less so than their West Coast counterparts who got a new contract last year. But they've been seen as militant. Moreover, their labor is critical, right? I mean, if you shut down ports, the impacts are immediate because we're living in a globalized economy, and it's just instantaneous if you've got finished products and parts that are used by workers at American factories, if you shut that down. So they are in this position where they can immediately cause pressure. But the pressure that's being felt most acutely right now is other parts of the supply chain. So, you know, I spent part of the first day of the strike at the port of Newark in New Jersey, which is the largest port on the East Coast. And I went to a truck stop where the people running the register said that they felt this kind of blue collar solidarity with the dock workers. The dock workers make $100,000, sometimes even $200,000 bucks a year after you factor in overtime. And they said, look, whatever, we're all blue collar together. We had to work through the pandemic together. But then I talked to these so-called dray operators. These are truck drivers who move containers between the ports and warehouses. Now, there's a lot of resentment there. Mm. There has been for a long time because they view the dock workers as the sort of aristocrats of the dock. They said, we get paid by the load that we deliver. The dock workers get paid by the hour. We're often sitting in our cabs for 6 or 7 hours at a time waiting to pick up a container. The dock workers don't let us use the restroom. They're not kind to us. They sort of lollygag, and we can see that they're getting paid no matter what. And now they're actually putting us out of work. This is a considerable tension because the people the dock workers want to hurt by demonstrating how crucial they are the operators of the ports. And those are these international shipping carriers. And perversely, they're the one group that actually stands to benefit from this, which undercuts their incentive to strike a deal.
They benefit.
Well,
yeah,
the prices go up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I mean, if you can't bring ships into East Coast ports, then you're stranding the ships that are waiting to load and unload. I mean, as we're having this conversation, there's something like 36 ships that are just stuck in anchor. They've arrived from Latin America, from Europe, from Asia, but they can't pull up to the docks because the dock workers aren't there to unload their cargo. So they're just waiting. And every week that the strike continues, I've seen some analysis, you'll get 60 more ships that are just stuck in these floating traffic jams. Well, a ship that's stuck off Newark or Philadelphia or Charleston or wherever is a ship that can't be deployed to Europe or to Latin America or to the West Coast of the U.S. to pick up the next load. So there's less capacity, and that means higher prices, and particularly given that while there are a whole bunch of international shipping carriers, they are organized in three alliances. Think like airline alliances, like Star Alliance or One World, whatever. Well, they've got a monopoly hold on the industry. There's three choices that control 85 to 90% of the most lucrative routes. Those are the routes from China to the West Coast of the U.S., from Asia to the East Coast of the U.S. via Europe. And so they are, ironically or perversely, in a position to jack up shipping rates and record record profits. And don't take my word for it, by the way. That was the warning I got from the chair of the Federal Maritime Commission, who I talked to the other night, who said, that's their template. When there's a shock, they jack up rates.
And so the party that the dock workers want to hurt are actually going to benefit from this. What are some of the other ripple effects? Because you said the truckers lose. Who else would lose in the supply chain?
Well, the first thing that happens is perishable food goes bad. Prices go up. Product gets scarce. This is particularly significant in Philadelphia, because Philadelphia is one of the largest refrigerated ports. Mm-hmm. That's to say, you know, containers that are refrigerated that are bringing in perishable goods like fruit, meat, anything that can spoil. But it's all along the East Coast. So if this goes on even just for a few more days, you could discover that bananas are hard to find. They'll be higher in price. There's worries about coffee, the meat supply. And then a little bit longer term, farmers in the Midwest especially, but in other parts of the U.S., use East Coast ports to export their goods. Mm. And if the ships can't dock, they can't pick up things like soybeans that go into containers. And so those exporters could really have a problem. And then the longer this thing goes, the more it spreads to just about every industry you can imagine, plastics, chemicals, every kind of retail, because ships that are suddenly turned into kind of involuntary warehouses that are just floating off docks are holding all manner of things, you know, exercise equipment, clothing, furniture, lighting, construction gear. This is particularly significant as, you know, we think about rebuilding from the hurricane that just swept through parts of the Southeast. Anything that comes into the U.S. by container ship, and that's a lot of stuff, is impeded, which means higher prices for consumers.
That is the voice of Peter Goodman from the New York Times, and we are talking about this ongoing longshoremen strike. It's happening here in Philadelphia and at ports along the East and Gulf Coasts. If you have questions about this, comments about this, give us a call, 888-477-9499, email studio2@whyy.org. Peter, something that you've written about quite a bit is the fragility of the supply chain and how that was exposed during all the stoppages and wonkiness that happened during COVID. Do you think that this has the potential to expose those flaws yet again? And I'm talking about the work stoppage. And, you know, is the downstream effect of this making us perhaps reconsider our reliance on these global supply chains?
Yeah, you know, to your point, I think that was something that was already happening. I mean, I think when you wake up in the middle of the worst public health catastrophe in a century and discover that you're dependent upon a single country, a country that we're not incidentally, you know, having a trade war with, that's China, for parts of ventilators, for basic chemicals that go into pharmaceuticals, for personal protective gear, and then things that may seem more frivolous but are really important when you run out of, when you can't get a barbecue in the middle of a pandemic when your family's cooped up, or you can't get an exercise bike to replace the fact that you can't go to the gym. That's something you remember. And a lot of that stuff is coming in from factories in China. And a lot of reason why it got so hard to secure was because these shipping carriers jacked up the prices of shipping sometimes tenfold in the space of a few months. And so really large companies like Amazon, Target, Walmart, they can afford to charter their own ships. Smaller businesses lost sales. They lost market share. Consumers were disrupted. So there was already a push to think about, you know, how do we move production closer to home? In some cases, you know, so-called reshoring, where you're moving jobs actually back to the United States. In some cases, looking to Mexico, to Central America. This will certainly be the latest reminder that if you're thinking about depending upon supply chains that stretch across oceans, there are risks there that we haven't taken for
real. There's volatility baked into the system almost. Yeah.
Yeah. And I wonder, are there any other ways besides, you said raising prices is one of the ways that these shipping carriers sort of pivot to you know, push the prices down the chain. I want to, is there a way that they can adapt and maybe go to other ports? Are there any other ways to get those goods to consumers?
Yeah, it's a really important question. And Avi, I realize I didn't fully answer your previous question, which is, you know, are we going to get these floating traffic jams like we got during the pandemic? And these things are related. So, yes, there are other ports, and that's happening. So we see a lot of diversion of shipments to the West Coast of the U.S., but the West Coast ports during the pandemic were the ones that were in the worst shape. I mean, the twin ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, that's the gateway to 40% of all imports arriving in the U.S. by container. And in the worst part of the pandemic, we saw 50, 60, 70 ships queued up, just floating out there for weeks at a time, waiting for a chance to pull up to the docks. Now, if enough stuff gets diverted west, we could see those queues build up again. Moreover, when you divert, whether you go to the West Coast, whether you go to Mexico, which is a conversation now because we've got rail and road links to Mexico, of course, you put strain on the rail and highway networks. And rail did really poorly during the pandemic. It's been hollowed out. Investor interests have taken primacy over operational interests. That's a story that goes all the way back to the robber barons, where it's about, you know, streamlining costs and handing dividends to investors. It's very unlikely that rail can handle a massive increase in demand if we start bringing stuff to the West Coast that's really destined for the East Coast. In terms of trucking, you know, we've downgraded truck driving to such an extent. It's always been a tough job, but it used to be a high-paying job, like being a dock worker. It's now downgraded to the point where it's basically a working poor job for a lot of people. Yeah. And so we keep, quote unquote, running out of truck drivers. That's the industry talking point. We've really run out of people willing to sign off for the very difficult and not very well compensated life of sitting behind a truck.
I want to bring in a caller now. This is Rick in Queen Village. And our producers tell us that Rick works in the food business. And by the way, if you are, you know, in the supply chain business, somewhere along the chain, whether you're a dock worker or you're like Rick working in the food business, we would really love to hear from you this hour. So let's turn it over to Rick now in Queen Village. Rick, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I just wanted to say that, you know, it definitely is creating some uncertainty for me in my business, but, like, it could possibly create some opportunities as well. Like, for example, if I have contracts to sell large quantities of poultry, my understanding is that there was a lot of poultry that was set to go overseas that can't now. So that there's a lot of excess inventory that needs to be blown out.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And,
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, there could be some opportunities to get good deals on stuff that was meant to go overseas.
So some people...
That's a great point.
Yeah, somebody's always making money when something like this happens.
Yeah, so Rick in Queen Village, thanks so much for that comment. Peter, can you reflect on that? Because this is causing, like you mentioned this earlier, stoppages in both directions, coming in, but also going out.
Yeah, no, that's right. If you strand exports, that increases the supply domestically, which should drop the price. That's not delightful to the people who produce poultry, but you know that's also an industry that's controlled by its own monopoly interests who've managed to, in many cases, manipulate the supply for their own advantage. So now they'll be on the short end of that one, which is not something they're really accustomed to. But you know, this dynamic can play in all sorts of ways. I mean, I spent some time in the worst of the pandemic disruptions with almond farmers in California who couldn't export their crop because the ships were making so much money moving factory goods from Asia to places like Los Angeles that they weren't bothering to unload and then send empty containers up to the Central Valley, California, to pick up almonds. Similar dynamics. Suddenly there's a big glut of domestic almonds. So the producers are taking it on the chin. But, you know, if you're in a business where you need almonds to make pastries or candy or whatever, the price just went down. This does play in lots of different directions. But you know, look, it's a globalized economy. U.S. businesses are generally vulnerable to shifts in the global economy because there's so much integration. So the net, while some people will benefit for sure, the net is pretty traumatic for the overall economy.
Mm. Yeah, and if you want to join this conversation that we're having with Peter Goodman, who is the global economic correspondent for the New York Times and author of the new book, How the World Ran Out of Everything, call us, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. We'd love to hear, are you worried about this strike? If you're a dock worker, trucker, working the business, dependent on the global supply chain, how is the strike impacting you? And so, Peter, I'm wondering if history can be a teacher to us, because Avi mentioned earlier that the last time this union went on strike, it was 50 years ago. Can you give us any context on how that happened and the outcome of that?
Yeah, so it was 1977. Strike lasted for 44 days. The ILA, this is the International Longshoremen's Association, which represents dock workers on the East and Gulf Coast, was actually viewed as a less militant union than its offshoot, the ILWU, that represented West Coast workers. And similarly to now, the ILA was kind of playing catch up, where the West Coast dock workers tend to be better paid. And that was a moment where it took 44 days to extract not only better wages, but also some promises about the pace of what we would now call automation, you know, basically supplementing people's work with machines. And this is a tension that really goes back to the beginning of container shipping in the 1950s. And the ILA was trying to get a handle on to the extent to which container shipping would spread and displace the old way of moving cargo, so-called break bulk ships that needed many more human hands to engage in the kind of three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle solving of, you know, how do you take a side of beef and fit it in the hull alongside barrels of chemicals and liquor? Well, along comes the container in the 1950s. It's a standard size box. You can move it on the back of a truck. You can move it on a train. You can lift it with a crane. It requires fewer people. And that was one of the reasons why port operators and shippers in general were so eager to see container shipping. So there are similar tensions in this strike as there were in the last one back in the 1970s.
And quick follow-up, did container shipping, it seemed like the container shipping didn't destroy the industry, and things and the number of people working actually increased over years. Is that correct?
Marginally, though not as a percentage of the amount of freight moving. I mean, look, anybody who's doomsaying about automation, like it's just automatically a job killer, has slept through the recent history of technology. I mean, when banks introduced ATMs, some people said, oh, this is the death knell for banking jobs. Well, it freed people up to do other sorts of jobs at banks, and we got more jobs than ever. Now, at the ports, there's no question that the dock workers have always been seen as, I mean, in from the perspective of management, they're the trolls guarding the bridge. You want to bypass them. You want to weaken their numbers because they can shut you down. And that is their way of militating for higher wages and greater job protections. And so dock workers are not paranoid when they look at automation and see it as engineered to diminish their power and limit how much of the bounty of moving cargo they get.
Peter, we're going to a break in about a minute. You're talking to a couple folks here in the state of Pennsylvania, a swing state, about a month before a pretty big election. So we have like 100 comments about the political implications of this. Sure. We're going to get to that after the break. I'm going to read a quote, though. This is from The Atlantic. Conflicts over automation all boil down to the same thing, how new labor displacing machines are being introduced and what unions are demanding to minimize their impact on the workers. I mentioned that's from The Atlantic. It's from a story called Automation and the Longshoremen, published December 1960. So that goes to Peter's point, right? This is a story with a long tail. And we do have a couple of emails about automation that we want to get to on the other side of this break as well. So we're going to go to a break. We're going to talk about the political ramifications, and we're going to talk more broadly about automation when we get back from that short break. You're listening to Studio 2.
Yeah, and if you're worried about automation replacing jobs in your field and you want to tell us how this strike is impacting you, you can call us. The number is 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Because down here it's still, who's your old man until you got kids your own? Then it's, who's your son? But after the horror movie I seen today, robots. Peter's full of robots. My kid will be lucky if he's even punching numbers 5 years from now. It breaks my heart that there's no future for the Sabatkas on the waterfront.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
Oh, boy. I'm Avi Wolf and Aaron. We're bleeping here. Okay. That was a clip of dock worker union boss Frank Sabatka from season 2 of the HBO series The Wire, which focused on the culture around the Port of Baltimore. And we're continuing our conversation now on the International Longshoremen's Association strike, which has shut down ports along the East and Gulf Coast.
And we are asking you, are you worried about the strike? If you are a dock worker, a trucker, you work in the business, a business dependent on the global supply chain, how is this strike impacting you? You can email studio2@whyy.org or call 888-477-9499. I want to reintroduce our guest. Peter Goodman is global economic correspondent for the New York Times and author of the new book, How the World Ran Out of Everything. Peter, we're glad to have you on the show.
And
I teed this up before the break, Peter. Lots of people asking about politics. Joseph says if it lasts long enough, it's bound to impact the election just in time for Election Day. Eric from Chestnut Hill, can Trump blame Biden for this? And then a couple of emails. I don't want to say conspiracy theory, but sort of trying to connect some dots here to ask whether this is somehow a political ploy. So Patricia says, my understanding is that the leader of this union is a supporter of Donald Trump. To me, that means he's willing to paralyze commerce and hurt people to help get the felon and Republican candidate into power. Mark is also wondering about the connection between Trump and the ILA, calling it a suspicious October surprise. So, Peter, can you address that specifically? Tell us first who the leader of the union is. He's been in the press quite a bit recently. And his connection to politics.
So the leader of the union is a guy named Harold Daggett, longtime longshore worker who has indeed posed for pictures with Donald Trump, met with Donald Trump last year, says he got Trump's support in the fight to stave off automation. It's unclear whether Daggett is an actual Trump supporter or somebody trying to curry favor, you know, sort of make sure that whatever happens, he's got his connection. I mean, there's no question that organized labor in another Trump administration would presumably be set back. Biden fancies himself the most pro-union president in history. One can imagine that whoever he appoints to positions like the National Labor Relations Board would be much less friendly to organized labor interests. But, you know, there is no question that this particular strike poses a real problem for Biden and Harris, and there are no good political options. And one can certainly imagine scenarios where this strike is of benefit to the Trump candidacy, because Biden's in a position where he can intervene. He can cite a 1947 law called the Taft-Hartley Act that gives him the power to declare an 80-day cooling off period and send the two parties back to the table. But he's really not interested in doing that because, again, he likes his pro-labor credentials, and labor's obviously a core Democratic constituency. Moreover, there's still a lot of anger within organized labor for Biden intervening to put down what might have been a railroad strike in 2022. And in that case, railroad workers got smaller wage increases than they sought, and they did not get paid sick leave, which was really just a great indignity when you talk to rail workers. So that's not very palatable to wade in. On the other hand, the longer this goes on, the greater the economic damage and the greater the risk that it revives product shortages, higher prices, just as we're supposedly declaring victory on inflation. It could come back, you know, in time for the holiday season, in time for the presidential election. So it's a very tough spot for Biden and Harris.
I want to read this email from Deborah, who says, I believe that throughout their history, unions have played a very important and key role in improving working conditions and wages for employees. However, I'm having a hard time with two of the longshoremen's demands. Their wage demands are far and above beyond reasonable. What regular employee receives such increases? Secondly, the opposition to automation is a classic knee-jerk reaction to improvements and cost savings, which makes us more competitive. And so I wanted to ask you this question, Peter. Could this backfire on the dock workers? Because there has been this talk about automation, and the dock workers are using their leverage in this way. And so would this sort of speed it up in some ways or cause people to sort of turn against them? Because a lot of folks do not feel that sort of solidarity with their cause.
I mean, it certainly underscores if you're management and your position is these human beings are a pain to deal with. You know, they have wage demands. They have the complications of humanity, families to take care of, children who might be homesick, interests that go beyond moving cargo on and off docks. And robots don't have any of those issues. This certainly underscores, you know, your inclination to get out from under human problems and deal with robot problems, which are much smaller problems. You know, that's true. On the other hand, I think it's fair to say that if you speak to even dock workers candidly, you know, not for attribution, there is a sense that automation is inevitable. Yeah. And it's a natural outgrowth of the human inclination to, you know, take things that are dangerous and physically taxing and make them less so. And the real question is, who's in control of the pace and for whose benefit? And American workers, dock workers included, are not wrong based on their lived experience to conclude, if I lose my job, I'm really in harm's way, which stands in contrast to other developed countries. I mean, we don't have national health care here. We have minimal help for workers who lose jobs because of trade or technology. We have minimal help for people in deindustrialized communities where everybody loses their job at once and everybody's house is underwater. And, you know, trade experts in places like New York and Washington say, oh, just train for a job as a solar installer in Arizona.
Right.
Well, okay, you know, who's
I don't live in Arizona. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, right. How am I going to sell my house? So this is a particularly American reaction against automation where workers are, you know, reflecting their lived reality to say change is potentially dangerous. No one's going to help me.
Yeah. Let me read another email on this topic from Trish, who says, I want to preface this by saying I'm a huge union supporter. So this question is not coming from a position of hate. But When people talk about automation taking their jobs, I just wonder, if that is true, how can we possibly fight against it? If automation really is a better way to do something currently done by humans, it just seems like we're trying to halt a natural progression in process improvement. But maybe you can explain to me why that is not the case. You did explain in some ways already, Peter, why workers feel so sort of acutely aware of and threatened by this. But I want to use Trish's email to maybe have you elaborate a little bit more. Like, can a union direct the way automation is used so that it's more to their benefit? Like, if they can't stop it, can they harness it in some way? And maybe use the example of the docks. Like, how is automation used on the docks? How could it be used? How could workers benefit? Where might they lose? Like, just give us a sense of how it can all be manipulated in some way from the union perspective to the benefit of the workers.
Well, it's happened before.
Yeah.
I mean, both the East Coast and the West Coast dock workers have extracted a kind of profit sharing as a condition of accepting automation. And I mean, this is basically where we're probably headed here. I mean, at least long term, because automation is not going to stop for all the reasons we've discussed. And so the question is, who gets the benefits? And the union has typically said, well, in fact, famously, there was this quote from Harry Bridges, who was the militant leader of the ILWU.
I had this written down, yeah.
Who said, at the end of all this, you know, there's going to be one dock worker who's going to be pushing the button on the machinery, and he's going to be the highest paid SOB in America. And so really what we're talking about is, what kind of compensation will the remaining ranks of this union get in exchange for what seems like their inevitable ascent? Now, I imagine dock workers would take strong issue with that, and right now they have power to stop automation from happening. But, you know, life is long.
And I just wonder what this whole automation is going to look like on the docks. Any ideas on that? Because I really want to have a better understanding of what they do now and what could change once this technology gets injected on the docks.
I visited one of the first fully automated terminals in the Netherlands at the Port of Rotterdam, which is the biggest container port in Europe. And the dock workers there, you know, they had opposed automation. They eventually accepted it for higher wages and greater job security for those still in the union. And they were sitting in these temperature-controlled offices operating a joystick.
That doesn't sound like Marlon Brando on the waterfront at all.
It does not sound like on the waterfront. You know, I mean, that's a cold, windy, rainy place.
Yep.
And they were indoors. And they liked that part of it. But they still looked at automation. They said, you know, trade deals, liberalization, bringing in lower paid, you know, Eastern European truck drivers, self-driving trucks, you know, it's all the same. It's all about shrinking our power on the docks and limiting what these guys have to pay us so they can keep more for themselves. And that dynamic, you know, is the overall frame for this whole conflict we're having.
I want to get you out of here. One more question, because we are running short on time, Peter. Laura asks, if we don't implement automation on our docks, will we be lagging other economies? You just talked about the Netherlands.
Yeah.
Like, if we don't embrace this fast enough, do Americans lose in the long run?
Well, you're not going to serve households and businesses in Philadelphia by shipping stuff into the port of Rotterdam, you know? I mean, you're not going to air freight everything from the Netherlands or Southern California or Mexico or whatever.
So there's some built-in necessity there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, place matters. I mean, you got to be close to the people you're trying to serve, and these ports are really significant. So yeah, I don't buy that at all. But I also don't buy this idea that automation is not going to happen.
Mm. Yeah, and can I wedge one thing in here? How far are these parties apart in these negotiations over this strike? Because are they close or no?
It's hard to tell, but again, you know, let's remember that there are reasons to doubt on both sides that there's an interest in a deal, right? Because the shipping carriers are potentially in a position to make record profits off this thing. That said, the positions that are public, the The port overseers are now offering 50% raises over 6 years. The dock workers have lowered their ask from an initial 77% increase to 60%. So that's a gap of about 10%. But the automation piece is significant. And then, you know, if you're partial to these conspiracy theories about the October surprise dimension of this in an election year, that's, you know, further reason to question whether the people at the table have an interest in making a deal.
Well, yeah. I got to say, we have a lot of guests on the show, Peter, but you were absolutely fantastic. Just broke it all down and did it solo, which is hard to do. That's Peter Goodman, global economic correspondent for The New York Times, author of the new book, How the World Ran Out of Everything. Peter, thanks so much for the time on Studio 2.
Thank you guys so much. Great to talk.
Yes. And
we got to put a bow on something now.
Yes, we got to put a bow.
This is exciting.
Yes. Our Studio 2 DJ. Go ahead, Avi.
Okay. So we asked you at the beginning of the hour, what song should we go out on today that's related to today's theme? And we got a lot of great suggestions. Deo by Harry Belafonte.
Not
Pete
bad.
Seeger's Which Side Are You On? Sort of a union tune. But the winner today is Craig, who convinced us with this email. In times of turmoil and strife, as we experience today, Otis's song brings us a refreshing sense of calm. That song is Sitting on the Dock of the Bay by Otis Redding. Thank you, Craig. And by the way, Scott in Westchester, Gail in Hatfield, Kathleen and Belinda in New Brunswick recommended this song. Thanks to Dan and David and Nancy and Susan and Judy and Bernie and everyone else who wrote in. Some great suggestions today, but Otis, you can't beat Otis.
You cannot
you just can't beat
Otis. Listen to that voice. It's so beautiful. But I love our listeners. So thoughtful. Great song.
All week they were great.
And I want to say thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager from Studio 2. At WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg, sitting on the dock.
I'm Avi Wolfman here. I'm about to do the whistle part, though. that was a bad whistle. I was laughing. I'm sorry.
We'll leave it to Otis.
Thanks for joining us this week. We'll be back next week with a lot more in Studio 2. We love our listeners. Keep those emails and calls coming. We'll talk to you soon.
Sitting on a dock of a bay, wasting time.